Okay, we are still reading, I believe it's chapter 16. It's called The Science of Knowing God, is what Swamiji has titled this chapter. These chapter numbers relate to the book, not to the Gita. The Supreme Science of Knowing God. And so we're in the fourth chapter of the Gita itself, and I'll read the Gita verses, and then we'll talk about them. 4:9. He, O Arjuna, who by intuition comprehends the truth of my divine manifestations and selfless deeds in this vibratory universe, will never again, after he leaves his body at death, need to incarnate in outward egoic form. Soaring in freedom, he will attain me. 4:10. Purified by ascetic wisdom, released from attachment, fear, and anger, and completely absorbed in me, many have attained oneness with me. 4:11. O Partha, Arjuna, in whatever way I am approached, in that way do I respond. All men, by whatever path, come to me. 4:12. Those who work to fulfill their earthly desires worship the gods, which are ideals in various forms. They are not idols. Aware that success of this kind can be reached with relative ease. 4:13. An admixture of the three gunas, the essential qualities, with the diverse karma of individuals produces the four castes. Though I am active in creation through these influences, know that I and myself am ever actionless and unchanging. 4:14. Though acting, I am without attachment, nor do I desire any particular outcome from activity. He, similarly, who is one with me and identified with my nature, is unfettered by the slightest desire for the fruits of action. 4:15. Understanding this, the nature of right action, the wise since earliest times have acted dutifully. Be like them, acting without desire for the fruits of action. 4:16. What indeed are action and inaction? Even the wise can become confused on this point. I will explain the distinction, armed with which knowledge you will be freed from all evil. 4:17. The nature of action is difficult to know. To understand it, know the difference between right action, wrong action, and inaction. 4:18. He is a yogi of true discernment who sees inaction in action and action in inaction. He is wise among human beings, for he has attained the goal of all action and is free. 4:19. He who never acts with the motivation of personal desire, whose ego-binding karma has been burned up in the fire of wisdom, such a one alone may be considered wise. 4:20. The wise, having relinquished attachment to the fruits of action, being ever contented and free in the self, do not really act, even if they appear to be intensely busy. 4:21. Even in doing physical labor, as opposed to meditative work, one incurs no karmic limitation, who has renounced all sense of possession, who is without personal desire, and whose feelings, citta, are under the control of the inner self. 4:22. He is free from karmic involvement, who is contented with whatever comes to him uninvited, who is even-minded and untouched by duality, who is without envy, jealousy, and animosity, and who finally views success and failure with equanimity. 4:23. All the effects of karma, action, are nullified in oneself, and one achieves liberation when ego attachment ceases, when one becomes centered in wisdom, and when all one's actions are offered up in sacrifice to the infinite. 4:24. For such a person, both the act of self-offering and the offering itself are equally aspects of the one spirit. The fire of wisdom and the person making the offering are both spirit. In this realization, the yogi, freed from ego identification, goes straight to Brahman, spirit. Well, that's the end. That's a lot of verses. A lot of stuff. Okay. Do we have any lingering questions or thoughts or ideas that came that after you all read all that? Or shall I just jump right in? I said jump right in? Okay, I will. You know, this is really this whole action, inaction, it's always that funny verse, action, inaction, and inaction, inaction. You know, you have to be able to look at it to know. But the supreme science of knowing God, this whole section is all about living and working in the world. It's one of the things that makes the Gita such a universally useful scripture, is that it isn't just about renouncing everything and going off somewhere else. One of the reasons that the Gita has endured for so many centuries, and why even now, after all this time, even though Paramhansa Yogananda came to America with a new expression of an ancient teaching, he brought this scripture right with him. You know, his mission from Babaji, which was, as we read in Autobiography of a Yogi, I've been fond recently of quoting that little paragraph, Babaji, Mahavatar Babaji, is in constant communion with Christ and the two masters, one with a body and one without one, meaning Babaji and Jesus, have together planned the spiritual salvation of this age. They are aware of the rampant material, the boomerang effects of materialism, I think, the boomerang evils, and the complexity of modern society and the all-pervasive influence of Western culture and the materialistic influence that has. And they've made a plan. It's a fascinating paragraph to just read. There's so many aspects of it that just go out in all directions. The real, even though Yogananda in this lifetime was trained by Sri Yukteswar, that Sri Yukteswar was the one to whom he gave allegiance, Master actually spoke that the real guiding force was Babaji, and that he himself, as we've said, was Arjuna in a previous lifetime, and Babaji was Krishna. And whenever Master would talk about the real direction of this work, it was Babaji to whom he would refer. And when he wrote that in Autobiography of a Yogi, you have that force of Christ in Babaji. Well, it would have been very easy when Jesus came to start his mission, and even though he came to the Jewish people, and the Jewish people had the Torah and the established Old Testament, the result of Jesus' time was that the Old Testament moved a little bit to the background. It wasn't obliterated. It's still there. It's still the Bible. You still hold the Bible in your hand, and you have the old and the new. But an entirely new scripture was created just to express the incarnation of Jesus. Master, however, came, and he brought with him the Bible and the Bhagavad Gita, the New Testament and the Bhagavad Gita. Master refers very little to the Old Testament, although some, you know, to there are different parts of it that he does refer to, but most of his teaching is more the teachings that came later on. But what he did was, he spoke of the commentary that he wrote, especially on the Bhagavad Gita, being a scripture in itself, which is to take that scripture and then build on it. So in that sense, it's really not that different than what Jesus did, because he took the Old Testament and then he built on it. And he came to fulfill the prophets, and his intention wasn't to discard the old, but just to go forward from it. So here, what Swamiji is addressing is a kind of eternal conundrum that devotees, especially in India, have always dealt with, and that sometimes it affects the minds of Westerners less, because we are so rajasic. Rajasic means just active, ego active. We're so ego active that the concept of not being active rarely occurs to us. Swamiji says, you know, in the ashrams in India, Swami himself found it he just didn't know how to relate to it, because people just sort of hang around a lot. You know, Vivekananda, when he came as a disciple of Ramakrishna in the late 1800s and the early 1900s, he started a whole social service movement. It was not really in India in the way that Vivekananda made it happen. He really made his brother monks become active and serve. And Vivekananda even counseled that Indians should not be vegetarians because they needed to be just more active and move more. Of course, that the British had just been bleeding the heart and soul out of the Indian people for a number of centuries, and out of their economy and out of their self-respect and out of their culture. So there was a certain need to whip them back up again, to stand on their own and be confident and manly in their determination. But nonetheless, what that touched and what's being touched a lot in this chapter is, what is the nature of right action? Because it's very easy to just think, this world is a dream. After all, what difference does it make? You know, where is the gain in all this blood, sweat, and toil to try to just, you know, make the ocean wave a little bit more nice over here when it's just going to dissolve again? Once I met Swami, these issues were never real to me because he was so practical in his idealism, which is one of the instructions that Master gave him. It's not sufficient to have high ideals. You also have to understand how to translate those into everyday life. Otherwise, you're just lost in your head. But in the first few years that I followed the spiritual path, before I met Swamiji, I was lost in my head, and I was with a whole group of people, and we were all lost in our heads. And there was an enormous amount of that kind of speculation. Well, if it's really all a dream, then what's the point? And it was marvelously self-justifying, and resulted, as Swami himself commented about the early years of our community up in Ananda Village. He said there were a lot of people there whose idea of spirituality was just, you know, go down to the river in the morning and come back in the evening, just to enjoy. After all, life is bliss. After all, you know, everything is just a dream. Then what's the point of striving for anything? And they would sort of say, essentially, to Swami, well, if you want to work hard, you know, that's your trip. But don't impose that on us. We're being spiritual. And you can tell them by their fruits, and all those people have since moved on, and the power of Ananda speaks for itself. But still, there is that thought in the back of your mind, what is the point of all of this? And it's really easy to feel that, especially when things aren't going your way, and you sort of see how unreceptive the world is to what you have to offer. But this chapter in the Gita really talks about how what the essence of the spiritual path is. And it puts it very simply and strongly. It's to overcome fear. It's to overcome ego attachment. It's to overcome anxiety of all kind. Whatever that verse was, he leaves behind. So sweet the way he put it. It was right at the beginning. Yes. Purified by ascetic wisdom, released from attachment, fear, and anger. Attachment, fear, and anger. I mean, just really think about what life is like if you don't have any of those qualities. There's so many marvelous meditations that you can do. So often in our lives, we imagine that the way to overcome the things that are wrong with us is to concentrate on those qualities. Years ago, when we were first here, I used to do these retreats for women. And, you know, we'd start, it would be an all-day Saturday, and we'd start in a circle, and I'd ask women to introduce themselves. And, you know, you really don't want to know how much intimate material women will spill to each other. You know, women who don't even know each other, 5 or 6 minutes, you're just learning all sorts of things about people's lives that, and as I said, I shouldn't be spilling the beans. You would be appalled. That's all I can say. I had run at that time these sorts of retreats many times, and invariably, you know, women would start. It would be about the third person before you'd have to bring out the Kleenex if you got that far, and people would be just telling you how much, you know, the difficulties they're facing, the problems with their children, the impossibility of the husband, the this and this and this and this, and everybody's all in the story. And it would all eventually come out well, and we'd all have a lovely, lovely day together. But I had this idea once that instead of introducing yourselves in terms of the problems that you've come here to solve and the despair you feel about yourself, why don't you just give us your name and then tell us the most wonderful aspects of your nature? And it was extraordinary to me because like the first person did it, the second person began to waffle, and by the time I got to the third person, she'd completely forgotten the instruction. It was just the ability to hold our minds toward what is wonderful. We're so much more inclined to focus on what isn't good. I recall once I had a career as a corporate trainer that lasted about a nanosecond. I did maybe 3 programs, and then it was clearly not my thing, and I didn't do it. But we were doing some program, I can't even remember what it was, communication? Why would we be doing this? I don't know why we even did this exercise. Oh, I think it was about positive communication. And somehow or another, I was talking about how you should go with people's strengths. This was about leadership. That's what it was. I was saying instead of always trying to, you know, hammer on people what's wrong with them, just find out what's good and flow with the strength. And I talked a lot about magnetism and how once you get discouraged, you lose all your energy. But if you keep your hope and your enthusiasm up, how much better things will be. And so I gave them some little exercise to do that was all about focusing on the positive. I had a couple of people in that class, they refused to do the exercise. I mean, not only did they disbelieve it intensely, but they just refused to do it. They just swore that there was no chance that it would be helpful to focus like that, that you just had to focus on the limitations, because otherwise, how would you overcome them? You know, there's these very sort of strong ideas about our attachment to so many of these qualities that really hold us down. Now, this is where I was going with all of this. I was, the revelation came to me when I was walking up the steps in my apartment, so I was associated with the steps, but had nothing to do with the steps. But it was just a moment. I can't recall what the context of my life was, but I just sort of turned the corner of the steps, and for just a moment, I really had a strong thought of how different the consciousness of a master is from the ordinary human consciousness. And the particular concept that came to me was that a master is absolutely fearless. I mean, just fearless. But think about it, because what is there in this world that could cause a master to be, what could he be afraid of? You know, the deepest fear that we all feel, to be imprisoned, to be physically tortured, to be separated from our loved ones, you know, just all of those different qualities, to have people that we love die or be hurt. Realize that the right understanding of this world takes away all those fears. It doesn't take away our compassion. It doesn't take away a kind of reflected sadness that the process of growing up, spiritually speaking, can be painful for people. Jesus wept. At times, he wept before he was crucified, but he didn't weep for his own anxiety, for the coming and going of his own body. You know, Jesus could raise the dead. Jesus resurrected his own self. Jesus could heal the sick. There was nothing in this material world that bound him. And he was identified with all of creation. His one little body, the fate of it, just didn't even matter to him. Swamiji tells the story of when Master was in the last days of his life, actually dictating that's the only time Swami knew him, was the last few years. But when he was dictating the Bhagavad Gita, Swamiji said he'd been working all day, and then they were taking a little walk around the compound of the ashram there. And Master was leaning on Swami's shoulder, arm, and then he stumbled and he started to fall. Swami became quite concerned. Master said, "I'm in so many bodies, sometimes I forget which one I'm supposed to keep moving." I mean, just think of that. Just being so equally present everywhere that the unique responsibility, Ananda, for this one, just slips out of your mind and the body doesn't go forward. Anandamoyi Ma, a great saint of India, she said, "I have to, if people didn't feed me, it would never occur to me to eat." She would just sit there and people would just literally put food into her mouth like a little child. And then she would forget entirely whether she'd eaten or not. Because it just, the relationship with this body had become so different. When we were, years ago when I used to work at Ananda retreat, I was doing a retreat, I think on the chakras. Yes, and we, as part of that, we went down to the river. You know, hardship duty, you get this one. And there were rocks, these big granite rocks. So we were doing the vibrations of the different chakras. It was actually a lovely exercise, but it was also just for the sheer fun in the middle of the summer of going to the river. So we had the water element represented by the river, and then the earth element stretched out on these magnificent granite boulders that line the Yuba River Valley. It's just to be stretched out on that one year. This is totally, I know I'm running a lot of threads, but I have them. One year, my girlfriend and I, Arati and I, we just went down to the river one afternoon. We played evolution. We'd start in the water, and then we'd gradually evolve, and we'd crawl onto the land. And then we'd go backwards in the evolutionary scale, and we go back in the water. We called it up from the muck. It became a very well-known and on the game, up from the muck, as we would evolve. Anyway, this day, I was lying on the boulder, and we were contemplating the air element by just looking. It's a rather narrow canyon where we were, so we were looking up the somewhat narrow canyon. Way up above us, there was a hawk circling like this. And because we were sort of trying to be expansive into the air, we were focusing on the space where that hawk was flying. And just all of a sudden, I thought, my, wouldn't my life look different? My own life look different if I were actually, even for an instant, able to transfer my consciousness into that hawk. And not even just be a hawk, but just look down, seeing me just sort of lying there on that rock and then getting into my little car and going back to my little life. You know, you see, it's all perspective. The life itself might not change at all. It could still be the same little story of the little thing that I do. But when I'm seeing it from here is where you see it. We see our lives from the medulla, because this is where the ego is centered. So if you really think about it, that's how you look at life, isn't it? And this is why when we meditate, we just shift our eyes just that little bit, because mostly we're looking straight out of the medulla, straight out of our two eyes, and we see this world of light and shadow. And everything in it is dual, isn't it? You know, it's dark now, it's hot today, it'll be cold in a few weeks, and just all these different things. Some of us are a little tired, but we won't be so tired in the morning. Just everything is these ever-changing waves. And where does that come from? This comes from the two eyes. And all that we do when we meditate, the meditation is so subtle. It's just this little tiny shift. We stop looking out at the world of light and shadow, and then it appears to go dark, and we raise our eyes just that tiny bit. And what up to the spiritual eye, what I would say to people when I would teach meditation one is, because, you know, you always think of concentrate at the spiritual eye, and there's this great tendency to kind of do that a little bit. You're like sucking your energy in. What you're actually doing is you're just sitting comfortably at the medulla where we're always sitting, and there's this great open window. And whereas we tend to usually to just look out like this, here's the world, and we just raise our eyes just above the horizon line. It's a very, when you find in your meditation that your mind is wandering, look, invariably your eyes have gone level again. And if you're dreaming, which sometimes it happens, your eyes, of course, have dropped. And you've dropped into subconsciousness, or you're restlessly staring straight out. If you simply lift your eyes, just that, you'll see all of a sudden you'll become much calmer and much more awake. Because this is super consciousness, especially if you lift your eyes outward, just literally as if the spiritual eye, which is where it comes from, is right there in front of you and you're just looking out through it. When we were designing this altar, we had this thought of making the spiritual eye large like it is, which had never been done at that time in an Ananda altar. There occasionally people had the spiritual eye, but it was always small. At that time, the whole thing looked a little different, and we had this idea to make a really big spiritual eye, and there was a whole lot of, like, concern, aesthetic and architectural concern about that. So I finally realized that conversation was going to get us nowhere. So one afternoon I got tin foil Christmas wrap, you know, foil Christmas wrap in the right colors, and a big piece of cardboard, and we made a 5-foot in diameter one out of Christmas paper, and we just stuck it up on the wall there. We had it up there for about a year, you know, but it was quite large. This is only 4 feet. We couldn't quite make it 5 because of the architectural element of the arches and so on. You know, it had to only be 4. We wanted it 5. But again, it was like no one was sure about it. So Swamiji was here, and that's one of the reasons we put it up. I said, what do you think? He said, it should look big enough so that you feel you can walk right into it. Wasn't that a beautiful way to put it? He said, it should be high enough that you have to raise your eyes to see it, and it should be big enough that you feel like you can walk into it. Isn't that a beautiful way to think about it? I mean, should, I don't mean should, but it was fine to do it that way, because you know every Ananda church does it a little differently. But I often think about that when you're sitting there meditating and you're looking into it, you know, you're going into the infinite. That's why it's so much better to think looking out from the medulla into the spiritual eye instead of concentrating at the spiritual eye in some way that's contractive, you see? The whole thing is about breaking this bond of identity that the soul has inaccurately formed through the means of the ego with the body and its smallness. That's all that spiritual life is, the sublimation of the ego, the identification of the self with the infinite. Well, when I was on the rock and then back when I was going up my stairs and thinking about the actual freedom of consciousness, the thought came into my mind, what would it be like to have no fear? And just really, just think about that, to have there be nothing that could frighten you. I kind of stopped on the stairs and just using a vivid imagination. Master says that the capacity to visualize and imagine is a very powerful tool for spiritual life because we're trying to experience something we haven't yet experienced. So being able to project yourself with your imagination or with visualization into it. Again, when I would teach meditation, I would explain it this way. You have to understand, because people teach visualization and they call it meditation, it's not quite the same thing. Visualize yourself and you're out in a meadow and then a big wonderful white horse comes and you ride the horse. And all of those are very nice things because we're so tense and nervous all the time. Sometimes we have to just put ourselves into imaginary worlds. But the ideal way to use visualization and imagination as a meditating devotee is to visualize and imagine that which exists, not a dream world that you're hoping, that you just wish you could go to, but to visualize the world that's really there. In other words, to align your mind with reality so the power of that can lift you. This is why Master said to memorize his poem Samadhi and to recite it at least once a day when you meditate. More times is better. It's an extraordinary practice to do that. It's one that I did not take up early on. I've taken it up, well, I've had different phases. In the first years of my spiritual life, when I used to be in a group meditation with a group of women, we recited it every single day. And then there was sort of a middle where I didn't do it so much, and then I picked it up again. That's what most of you know, the verses on the wall are from, and the whole poem is in the back. Master wrote in words, and it was a unique contribution, it had never been done before, that he verbalized in the language of poetic English the experience of cosmic consciousness. And because those words are from a master, when you recite those words, vanish the veils of light and shade, lifted every vapor of sorrow. Just even that phrase, lifted every vapor of sorrow, sailed away all dawns of fleeting joy. Gone the dim sensory mirage. Just like the phrases are just extraordinary. And when you repeat those mentally, and you can repeat it out loud, but when you're sitting and meditating and you just start in with those words being, you know, memorized them and just saying them again and again, they're just the vibration of them just all of a sudden harmonizes your vibration with that reality. And it becomes to a certain extent, it's life-changing. It's really incredible. I can't tell you how many meditations I've just been thinking, boy, this one is really a dead loss. And I'll think, well, why don't we just recite Samadhi? You know, it'll just kill the rest of the time. And then, you know, 45 minutes later, and the transition was just the poem. Because somewhere, you know, one starts restlessly and then somehow or another the power of it takes over, and by the time it's finished, you're not thinking about getting up anymore. Because it's just there with you. The problem is Master told us to do so much. Speaking of that, this one I've never done, but his actual instructions for using Whispers from Eternity is to memorize one poem at a time and repeat it from memory over and over again until you've drunk everything it has to drink. From the experience of samadhi, I think that would be a marvelous thing. I have a strange other little conundrum, which I know I've shared with you all, that from all my past lives as a political revolutionary where I've ended up in prison, which God willing I won't this time, I always think about how useful it is to have memorized all these things for when we all go to jail. You know, almost every time I do the Festival of Light, I think, well, when we're in prison, we'll be able to reconstruct this from memory. It's probably a really negative affirmation. Isn't it goofy what we think about? So I always think it would be nice if I knew more Whispers by heart. That's completely beside the point. But not really, because what we do with our inner landscape is everything. Now, this whole chapter, which I haven't even... Well, I have been talking exactly about what it's about. But this whole chapter is all about what is right action. You know, what is it to do the right thing? And I mean, I know all of us face this question. Am I doing the right thing? Am I doing my dharma? Am I where I should be? What am I supposed to do? But it's so interesting in this whole chapter, because this whole chapter is not about any specific line of work, so to speak. It's just all about what right action is. And right action is all about the consciousness with which you do things. We have a book now, a little booklet, which I think we call Guidelines for Members of Ananda Sangha. It's changed its name many times. It used to be called Rules of Conduct for Ananda Members, and now it's been called Guidelines, which is a much better thing for it, because there isn't a single rule in the book. And the guidelines are probably better, but it's the most interesting thing. It's like, it's the monastic rule, so to speak. It's the equivalent of the monastic rule for our spiritual community. And there's not a single rule in it. It doesn't say anything about what you're actually supposed to do, but it tells you the attitude to have toward everything you do, and everything else will follow from that. Swamiji gave us this very interesting progression of his own thinking at one point when he was, this must have been many years ago, I think he was writing a book about leadership. I'm not really sure. When Master was alive, when Yogananda was alive at his ashram in Mount Washington, they were not very organized, you know, in the way that most people think about organization. Things didn't follow a nice linear pattern. They didn't have departments. They didn't have department heads. They didn't have department procedures or anything like that. In fact, things ran a little bit chaotically. There wasn't a kind of consistent development, and people were changing around all the time. And Master interrupted the smooth running of the organization rather constantly. And there were people who would comment about his lack of organizational ability, so to speak. And in fact, one monk who Swami quotes in The Path, who left the ashram, not surprisingly, there was some comment about organizing the work, and this monk said, "Organize hell, all he ever does is disorganize." You know, just meaning he was so unpredictable that you could never get things into order, which is everybody loves to have the system down. And Swamiji had sort of, as he put it, he'd sort of just kind of accepted this, because after Master died, for the 14 years that Swami was still in SRF, Self-Realization Fellowship, Swami actually organized things. He brought system and order into what was going on there. As he put it himself, he's responsible for ruining the organization. And in fact, from all the system and order he brought into SRF, he knew what not to do by the time he got to Ananda. But he realized one day, he said, Master was a superb organizer. He said, but he organized entirely on the basis of magnetism. It was that he created a very powerful magnetism, and if you aligned yourself with it, then everything went in perfect order. And of course, that's exactly how Swami has structured Ananda. We have a little bit more, but that guidelines for conduct is exactly that, which is there's this powerful ray of energy, which is the divine energy. For those of us who are disciples, which is almost all of you, that ray has a specific character to it. It's not different than the sunlight that illuminates it, but just the same way that the light comes through many different windows, and when the light comes through different colors, it looks different ways. It's the same sunlight behind it, but it's shaped by the window through which we see it. And we, as members of this particular spiritual family, or all those who are members of whatever spiritual family they're part of, there's a certain sameness to that. It's even fun here, you know, because I'm up in the front a lot on Sundays. Whenever someone from SRF comes in, we always know it. I don't mean that in a bad way at all, because they're almost like us. There's a tremendous amount of energy that's the same, and then they're just like us, but not quite. And then we think, oh yeah, they're SRF. And almost invariably, it turns out to be true. You can recognize Germans no matter what country you're in, or French, or sort of a game to see sort of who these people are. And it's not hard to do. Swamiji used to tell me that was possible. I didn't believe him until I started traveling. And you just would see it. When we've gone to Goa in India, there's a lot of Russians there of a certain type. It's very interesting. You just, who are those people? Oh yes, those are the Russians. You know, they just, especially this very rough and tumble kind of Russian that's around right now, the ones that come to Goa have enough money to come on that trip. Anyway, there's this certain vibration, and you tune into that vibration, and that is your right action, you see? Because once you have attuned yourself to the right action is that, Swami uses the word sublimating, the ego sublimating energy. It's not a word that I've used that much. So it was an interesting word to sort of tune into. The ego is sublimated to the divine force. And once you do that, all action is right action. Because once your consciousness is right, then everything else follows naturally. And if your consciousness is wrong, nothing will work anyway. I mean, so often we agonize so much about externals. And very commonly people will, you know, I pray and pray, what should I do, what should I do? We don't get an answer because there is no answer. It's not a question that God has an answer to. He really doesn't care. We think it's so important from our little perspective, whether lying on that rock and the hawk flowing up there, you know, whether I get up and I walk to this little house or that little house, and when I get there, you know, am I living alone or am I married or do I have a baby and how do I earn my money? And it just, from here, it all looks so incredibly important. From the perspective of the hawk, it's just little tiny things just going in all directions, and all the little details don't make any difference. But the consciousness that we do things with is enduring. Everything else just comes for just a second and then just goes away. I wrote in the monthly letter, I don't know if you all just got it, but I commented that I first learned about reincarnation when I was 20. And I was before I was 20, I was persuaded of it as an idea, but it was so theoretical that I might someday have another body. Well, you know, it's a lot less theoretical now. That's all I can say. You know, you just see that it just whizzes by. It just sails right by. And I think back about all those events and everything that happened, and I've had wonderful experiences in my life. But still, all that's really endured from it is what one becomes through it. And so in the Gita, it says very simply, right action is that action which... He says is performed, first of all, right action is that action which is performed with full divine awareness. Isn't that a sweet way to put it? And because, you see, again, even a leaf, if offered with devotion, that's elsewhere in the Bhagavad Gita, isn't it? We think we have to have so much together. We have to be so worthy before God will love us. It was very interesting to me. I was reading a question that someone asked, and they said that, let's see the context. The context was, in the Gita it says that you should offer God even your failures. It was a question from this book. He said, but, you know, we've been taught that whatever you offer to God, you offer the best. So I want to offer the best that's in me to God. Why would I offer to God the worst? Interesting question in a sense, isn't it? Well, the answer is you can look at it from many angles, but the thought is, if you have a child and that child does something really stupid and gets himself in trouble and then just hides, is afraid to tell you what he's done, and thinks, oh no, this is my problem, I have to solve it myself, and that child won't come to you as a parent and say, help, you know, I don't know what to do, I've made such a mess of it, I feel so bad in myself, what should I do now? Think how touched and loving a mother is or a father is when the child has the courage to come forward and tell the truth about what has happened. Isn't that so? I know certainly the way my parents raised me, there was no transgression that was as serious as lying about what you did. You know? And it was a very powerful principle in my household, which my parents executed very skillfully. You know, it wasn't like if you told the truth, there were no consequences. But the consequences for not telling the truth were way over the top compared to anything else that you did. It was just really important. But of course, when the child comes and said, I've made this mistake, now what do we do? Then the parent can work with him. Now, what kind of child won't tell his parents? I remember a friend of mine who came from a very, well, I guess what you would call now dysfunctional family at the age of 8. I didn't know words like that, and it wasn't a common word anyway. I just knew that her house was different than mine. But every time she'd make any mistake, her entire consciousness was how to hide it from her parents. And when I first saw that in her, I didn't even know where to put that. There was no part of me that knew how to relate to that because, one, I knew resistance was futile. You really better come clean. But also, the relationship with my parents was such that if I made an error, there was a respectful willingness to work with me. And I was never afraid for my parents to know. Sometimes I was ashamed or concerned about what might happen, but I never had a fundamental fear. And what I saw in her was a fundamental fear of having her parents know because they were unreasonable. Okay? Now, think about that in our relationship to God. Think about that in our relationship to Guru. If we have a fundamental fear when we stumble and fall, which make a long list, who is not going to? Every single one of us, of course we will. If you have any energy at all, you're going to make lots of mistakes. Because we're stupid and we're pursuing all kinds of things and we just don't have our act together. If we did, we wouldn't be who we are. And you pursue it and you're well-intentioned, but the ego gets involved. And as Swami said so sweetly to me, whenever your ego gets involved, Asha, you make terrible decisions. And I do, of course. I make terrible decisions and then really awful things happen. But if you believe at all that your mother loves you, you rush to your mother when that happens. You don't hide away in the closet and say, I have to solve this myself. And you see, how can God help us? And how can that be a sign of anything except fear and shame, which are really the fetters? What fetters us is not the action. What fetters us is our consciousness. And what are we identifying with? That's the subtle thought that permeates this book. It's only a question of what you identify with. That's such a profound thought. It's not a question of what we are. Because what we are, and it's, you know, it's New Age jargon to say that, but still it's true. We are the infinite spirit. But just merely to say that is not the same as realizing it, because we still identify with something other than that. But it's just a question of having identified with the wrong thing. Just as simple as that. I thought I was weak and now I'm strong. Just all those wonderful childhood stories about, the lion that gets born into the herd of sheep and thinks itself a sheep and doesn't know that it's a lion and then discovers that it's a lion. It's true, nature was never changed. It just got a little confused. And going up the stairs there, I thought to myself, when I cease to identify with all of these limitations, just imagine what that will feel like. And sometimes in meditation, it's something wonderful to play with. Another visualization we used to do in those kinds of retreats is I sort of do a double reverse almost. Like, think about whatever quality it is that you feel holds you back more than any other quality. And most of us usually have a kind of core quality. In fact, I have found it helpfully spiritually to, if I'm going to concentrate on anything, I try to concentrate on one quality, just one thing that I see that's making my life unhappy. And, you know, focus clearly on the limitation that vibration imposes you on you. And then just imagine for a moment what it would feel like to have it gone. And just feel all the freedom that would come to you when it's gone. And it's only a question of just habitually having defined yourself that way. Swamiji writes something very interesting in here, which he talks about the spiritual path, and this is in relation to the sloka that says, many have realized me. It's such a fun chapter, just a fun verse. Many have realized me. This isn't something that just a few do. Many have realized me. I love the way that. I think about that often too. Many have done this before. You know, we don't know them all because they've floated off into the ether and only a few of them come back. But just think how many have gone this way before us. That's why Swami says, be a Jivan Mukta, at least a Jivan Mukta in this lifetime. At least dissolve your ego. It's not that hard to do, he says. You know, I've been hearing him say those things for a really long time, and I used to always think, yes, it is. But more recently, I've thought, no, actually, it isn't that hard. It's not that I just don't know. I don't know what to think. But a part of me thinks, it isn't that hard. It's just a question of shifting your identity. Instead of constantly clinging and identifying with all those little crummy things, just identify with the infinite. That is right action, which is performed with full divine awareness. And Swami writes in here about how, and it's very important, because we see these false ideas get deep into our subconscious, and then we have a whole lot of other delusions that follow from them. And one of them, he says, is that the spiritual path is arduous. But arduous in the way he uses the example, like climbing Mount Everest. That the higher you get, the more dangerous it gets, the harder it gets, the colder you are, the more your life is threatened, the more you're struggling. I don't know if you all read the mountaineering books. I read lots of mountaineering books. You know, those last feet and how their feet are frozen and their hands are frozen and they can't think. I don't know why I like them. They're good stories. You know, they finally get there and they're just too cold and completely oxygen deprived even to enjoy it. And we, in a way, there's a part of us that thinks of the spiritual path that way. Because we sense that it's a challenge, don't we? We sense that there's a distance to cover. And it's really hard for us to think that it isn't difficult. And we also think of it as the more you accomplish it, the more difficult it is. And oftentimes when they people who don't understand, portray something spiritual, they can't understand effort that isn't tense. I recall one movie about Jesus that overall wasn't terrible, but every time he did a miracle, you know, he would do a miracle like this. You know, and then when he was done, he would be completely sweating and drained, you know, like, because they just couldn't think about how it was, but in fact, he would just go like that. You know, just, there are the jugs of water, and then they were wine. Lazarus, come out of the tomb. You know, he didn't have to chip away and slave it. It was just, the energy just flowed effortlessly from him. And this is how Swamiji writes, that the more you advance on the spiritual path, the more relaxed you are. Because, you see, the effort is in holding the ego together and holding on to this, all of these anxieties to keep ourselves so compressed. That's the strain. The spiritual path is just an ever-increasing flowing out into everything that is. It's a completely different reality. Do you have any questions or comments about anything I've said so far? Is everybody in 100% agreement and complete comprehension? All we have to do now is just a little thing like that. It's very fun to get older. It's instead of things getting more discouraging for me, they've gotten a lot freer. I pray for everyone. It's just really nice. You just stick with it. You don't quit. As long as you don't quit, it's surprising. That's just exactly what he said. If you don't quit, you're walking into freedom. I was wanting to say that. How to put it? I know that the thought that I had. If you're approaching the spiritual path in such a way that it makes you tense, it's not the fault of the spiritual path, it's the fault of your approach to it. And Swamiji said that to me once, and it's so many things that Swamiji has said over the years. It takes so long to understand what they really mean. I mean, he said to me, I remember, God doesn't necessarily want you to be unhappy. He said, that's what you're imposing on the situation. And I just remember, you know, sort of worrying about it. You know, I just took it in exactly the wrong way. But it's always stayed in the back of my mind. Because somehow, one of those subconscious misunderstandings we have is that we're not tense, we're not trying hard enough. And that somehow tension and anxiety is a sign of our conscientiousness. It's that same misunderstanding that I was starting with. If I don't think about my problems, how will I ever solve them? There's this one story that we often marvel. There was this devotee who came to Ananda, and she had very good karma, and she ended up, Swami was willing to help her a great deal, and she was almost immediately included in many of the smaller gatherings with him and so on. And but after a while, she actually said she really didn't want to spend that much time with Swamiji because when she was with him, she couldn't remember her problems. And she was concerned that if she didn't keep her mind on her problems, she would never solve them. And it was sort of like, you sort of didn't know where to go with that. You didn't know exactly where to put that energy because what happens in the presence of expanded consciousness is your consciousness expands. And when your consciousness expands, that which seems so utterly pressing and overwhelming simply doesn't. My pet theory, which has absolutely no metaphysical basis whatsoever, is that we actually never change at all. We just get so much bigger that the same problems just don't dominate our consciousness. That exactly the same faults stay with us till the end, but they become a smaller and smaller percentage of the whole. Until finally, you know, something that's 90% of your reality is overwhelming. But when it comes 0.1% of your reality, it's just a little fact over in the corner. Swamiji was commenting in a specific way about something that had been very troublesome to us at one point, but now had been neutralized. And I referred to that difficulty as sort of like little terriers napping at our heels. He said, no, he said, it's like a certain kind of spider, which I think he was speaking factually. He said, it has a very poisonous bite, but it's so small, its little jaws can never get a purchase. So it's sort of like we have these difficulties that are bad qualities, but we become too big for them to really poison our awareness. They just become just a little part of something. Just a little bit of our nature. It's the sign of attunement is joy. Remember that question was asked? I think Tony was the one who asked it, or someone asked it. How can you tell if you're in tune? The whole exercise of the spiritual path is to disidentify with the ego, to sublimate the ego. That is wrong action. The Bhagavad Gita says, when I was starting to read this, in the Gita, it tells us to beware of the thought that I am the one doing this. And that's also the flaw in holding too tightly to our mistakes. Because, you know, these mistakes are mine. This was my failing. I was the one who misunderstood. I'm the one who's so terrible. I'm the one who hurt everyone. I'm the one who's so helpless. And all that focus on the self, that's wrong action. Master said, whenever you fall into a mood, Satan has a hold of you. That's how he put it. And we're so often so convinced, you know, that I must be moody about this because I have to think about it. And how dare I be cheerful thinking what I did. In the book I wrote about Swamiji, there's the story in there about that girl who did something really stupid. Mercifully, I've forgotten entirely what it was. All I remember is that it was stupid and that it directly impacted Swami and it caused a lot of ripples and It was not a good thing to have done. Days later, she was still moping around. Swami finally said, why are you so, you know, what is wrong with you? Oh, she says, I feel so badly for what I've done. That you sort of think that you're being conscientious, don't you? You think that, you know, it's like, I this was so wrong of me. I have to just keep thinking how wrong of me it was. He said, what an egoist. She says, I'm not proud of what I've done. I'm ashamed of it. I mean, so she was a little rebellious. He said, I didn't say you were an egotist, which is a person who is too proud of themselves. He said, you are an egoist, which is someone who thinks too much about themselves. Has their consciousness too self-concerned? The path, spiritual path, is just sublimating the ego. Another way to put it is just self-forgetfulness. Just so lost in the service of others, the concern for others, the contemplation of the beloved, that there's just no room for self-concern. Aren't those the most beautiful people that you know? The ones who are just, how can I help you? What may I do for you? Swamiji even tells us, and it's so moving. And the day's coming up soon, September 12th. On the first day he met Master, Master turned and with those eyes looked at him, said, what may I do for you? Sometimes I just contemplate that. You know, just, what if you were sitting in the presence of the Guru? He says, what may I do for you? What can you do for me? What a question. Let me make my list. But Swamiji's answer, too, was just so powerful to contemplate. I want to be your disciple. He didn't ask for anything specific. He said, I want to follow you. That's what you can do for me. You can allow me to follow you. You can accept me as the one that you're going to train. You can give me liberation. He was asking for liberation. He was asking to come to God. The Master said, I'm not taking as many people as I used to. You know, tested Swamiji a little bit. But these are such beautiful stories. What may I do for you? Well, I want to be your disciple. What does that mean? And in India, they have another word, which is actually the word we use for our house, chela. And the etymological root of chela is the same as child. And the word chela is used much more than disciple, because of course English is not the first language, but chela is a much nicer word. Disciple is a beautiful word. Disciple has its relationship, however, to discipline, which is a wonderful word also, because discipline is not anything to be afraid of. In the Gita, Swami has this wonderful phrase, he calls it the freedom to follow every whim and do anything that you feel like doing is self-demeaning. That was the word he used. I mean, sometimes, you know, the perfect expression, because people will say, well, what's wrong with just following my desires and being a hedonist and being a libertine? We were all into that at a certain point. You know, it's just breaking out of all these restrictions and in fact, Swamiji himself said, it's better to follow your own experience than to just take other people's word for it. When someone asked him in the 60s, you know, what do you think of the sexual revolution and all the breakdown of traditional morality? And he said, overall, he said, I think it's a good thing. It's not at all the answer you would expect from an Orthodox Swami. But he said, because people are making their own experience the criteria of their values. He said, rather than somebody's dogmas. He said, and if they're honest in their own experience, they will discover true values. But if they're dishonest, they won't. But of course, that kind of hedonism that, you know, I and others embraced in my late teens and so on, for I was never a very good hedonist or libertine, but I made a little sort of feeble showing at it. I had too many yogic samskaras to really be very good at it, but I talked a good story in any case, and I was theoretically committed. But Swami speaks of such a thing as self-demeaning because it commits us to the lowest denominator of our nature. You know, the physical, animalistic, tamasic, intoxicated, who cares about anybody else, I'm just going to have a good time, is that the only thing wrong with it is that it doesn't work. You know, the sin of it, so to speak, is not that you'll go to hell by and by. It's that you'll find yourself in hell it you know, sexual promiscuity just completely messes up your magnetism. And you'll, it makes it very difficult to attract a true and loving partner. What to speak of the debilitating and the coarsening effect it has on your consciousness. And intoxicants do the same thing. And, you know, all the arguments about what's addicting and what isn't addicting. If you constantly rely upon some external to shift your consciousness so you can have peace of mind, you don't ever have peace of mind because you're completely externally reliant. And so that's what the words he used, it's self-demeaning. It takes the nobility represented by the great saints and masters, and it just makes us like puppy dogs, you know, by comparison. And that's why you so often see on the a certain expression that comes across the saint, the face of a saint, which is just this extremely kind, not an ounce of judgment, but this sort of faraway sadness when they see someone. I've seen it on Swamiji's face so many times when he would try to help someone, including me, try to help someone escape from a karma that he can see is going to cause you suffering, and he won't let it go. And he can't push because no one can force you. That's the great myth of a teacher, is that they can make you do something. They can't make you do anything. If you don't want to, they can't force you. And that's not a true teacher. That's just a dictator and a bully. But a true teacher can only awaken your own understanding. So if they have given you as much energy as they can and you can't understand it, then this just, I will wait. Look comes over their face. I will wait. And when you become sensitive after a while to that look externally, if you happen to be able to receive it from anyone, or you become very sensitive, it's the same, you feel it in your heart. You have this thought that you're just going to go do this, or you go off and you get so, you go into, well, we're doing the battle of Kurukshetra. You go into the battle of Kurukshetra and you do battle with some part of your ego, and you lose, and your ego comes out victorious, and you're strutting along thinking, you know, just what a hotshot, rooty-tooty sort of devotee you are, and then you just feel this quiet sadness in your heart that you know is Master sighing, thinking, oh well, here we go again. And all it is just we're just condemning ourselves, and that little rooty tooty cycle, just run it cycle again, and then we're so embarrassed because we've demeaned ourselves. It's such a fantastic word, isn't it? But that's all we've done too, because a saint is a sinner who never gave up. And then we have to be like little children where we started. You have to run to Master and say, oh, look, we made a mess of it again. You know, help me. I remember once I was in a position where I was facing a very difficult test. Not only did I not have the ability to resist it, I had no interest in resisting it, generally speaking. I was quite enamored of my enamoredness, but I knew it was wrong also. You know how we are. And so every morning in meditation, I would pray to Master, Master, I have no willpower. If you test me, I will fail. So I can just sort of promise you that. So the only hope in this situation is you must protect me from every opportunity to go in the wrong direction. And then it would be like sort of this little game all day long as I would try to find opportunities to get around him, and he would constantly thwart me. It became very dear until I gathered myself together and was able to go on the right path without the full security field around me. But, you know, this is the relationship of the chela. That's what I was going to say. The chela, the child. The child doesn't fear. Be ye therefore as little children. I talked about this a little on Sunday. And so it's very nice. Think of yourself more as Master's chela. That's what we called our house Chela Bhavan, the house of the disciples. Think of yourself more as Master's child. And think how that changes everything. Also then, you know, a child doesn't have to pretend. Just think how little children are. Something goes wrong, they just start crying and hold their arms up. You know, they don't have to pretend. They trip over their own feet and fall on the concrete, and especially little ones. You just see little ones. They just fall and then just, you know, and then they just, there it is. Just in the privacy of your own inner relationship with Master, you don't have to be important. Ego sublimation. You don't have to be important. You don't have to have your life together. It's such a relief. It's just such a relief. Because the rest of the time we have to pretend. You know? We have to sort of pretend to be grown up. People look at us and we think we're grown up. What a joke. One day, I don't know why this was so funny, but David and I, this was like 20 years ago when we were first starting here, and we didn't have this church yet, and we had just gotten our white robes, and we were just beginning to play the role that we've come a lot more comfortable with. And I was giving Sunday service, giving the sermon as usual, and I just didn't have any energy. I said, David, say something funny to me, just like, you know, lift my mood. He said, you and I as ministers of this church, which just struck me as hilarious. And I could hardly keep a straight face. All the way through the sermon, the thought would come back to me again, and I would think, this is so absurd, you know, just in this role. In other words, to take ourselves seriously in this. Well, you see how humble Swamiji is. He was here. 350 people had jammed into this place to see him. He finished talking, and just like a little child, he said, Asha, what happens now? Or, no, what am I supposed to do now? He said, you know, no. Hello, I am Kriyananda, you know, bless you, my children. He just said, Asha, what are we supposed to do now? I said, well, sir, if you sit here, they're all going to come and greet you. He said, okay, I'll sit here. Just so humble and childlike. It's not a pretense. You know, so many qualities. I wrote this again. I always refer to this book because it's such a good book. I wrote in there that the gradual realization on my part, you know, I work hard to have the right attitude. And by the grace of God, I don't always fail. And over the course of time, I have to say, in honesty, I have accomplished. I'm a better person than I used to be. You know, it's no small claim. But still, a lot of times, I know what I'm supposed to do, and I do it with willpower. I do it joyfully with willpower. But there's a part of me that it has to be disciplined in order to do that. There's a part of me that wants to demean itself with wrong attitude. But with Swamiji, that which he puts across is not an act of willpower. One example that comes to mind is I was 22 when I met him, and you know, through my early 20s, I worked as his secretary, and I'm very opinionated, even if I know nothing about things. And I used to be even worse. Just thank God you didn't know me then. And I would just insist on my point of view lots of times with him, based on nothing, except just, I don't know what, I thought it was a good idea, you know, I don't know what. But 25 years later, and he was always very respectful, 25 years later, when I'm here, and I'm working with people where the age gap is the same, and sometimes people who are very strong-minded, who don't have as much experience in the subject that we're talking about, yet have the same insistence, it's my karmic return, you know, and there'll just be this little temptation in myself to say something like, you're just a child, what do you know? I mean, that's the way to silence opposition, just demean people. But I refrain from that as much as I can, because in all the years that I've known Swamiji, I have never heard him refer to my age or to my lack of experience, and not once. It's like he doesn't cheat when he relates to you. You know, he doesn't pull rank. But he never referred to it. So I, when I realized this, I was so appreciative. And the next time I saw him, I said, you know, Swamiji, I'm so grateful that you were so respectful to me. I said, I never once heard you refer to my age, even though you're 20-some years older. And he sort of looked at me for a moment, and he said, I never noticed. He said, age is just a factor of the body. He said, I never see anyone according to their age. He said, not even children. He said, the soul is ageless. You know, just like it takes what you think you're doing and it goes to there. It's like it's not a question of right attitude, we should be respectful. It's that why would you even see that? He just related to what he saw. And that's what I realized, that he relates to what he sees. He doesn't discipline himself to love people. He just sees the divine everywhere. Now that's what we're working toward. And how do we work toward that? By consistently, day by day, with a tremendous sense of vigilance, realize that we are in the battle of Kurukshetra for our very lives, and that this is where we're going.